America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to more news from WBEZ anytime on the WBEZ app. Start each day informed. Tap and listen live or on demand. Available on iOS and Android.
Happy Friday, Chicago. Before we head into the weekend, we gotta catch you up on the latest happenings across the city and Illinois in our weekly news recap. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Today, we're bringing you a special weekly news recap that had a live studio audience. And we went behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
Chicago police will not be able to enact so-called snap curfews.
Which would allow Chicago police, of course, to issue a curfew with just 30 minutes notice.
The next violent teen takeover that happens when the blood sheds, it's on them.
Rents are high, housing is scarce. It's a problem Chicago has been facing for years.
We need to create more affordable housing, but we just need to create more housing in general.
As housing supply becomes more available, that's going to ultimately drive the pricing down.
I spoke with Axios Chicago reporter Carrie Shepard, WBEZ education reporter Sarah Karp, and Block Club Chicago reporter Quinn Myers, who covers the Wicker Park, Bucktown, and Westtown neighborhoods. We kicked off our conversation by talking about city council. I asked Quinn what alders took care of in their final meeting on Wednesday before heading out. And we started with accessory dwelling units, or ADUs.
Well, so ADUs, coach houses, basement apartments. Some people use the term granny flats. I've actually never heard anyone really use that term in real life. But basically, this is, the ability to add an extra unit on your property. And since 2021, there's been a limited pilot program that allows certain areas of the city to do this without having to go get a zoning change, which is this laborious and expensive process going down the city hall, possibly hiring an attorney. And housing advocates have been wanting to expand this citywide for a long time. They got really close this week. This ordinance that Bennett Lawson, Lakeview Alderman, put forward passed the zoning committee, and then it got deferred by some opponents at the final city council stage. But it will almost definitely come back as soon as September for a final vote, which would basically allow, with some restrictions, homeowners, building owners, to build ADUs as of right on their properties citywide.
I know you said people don't normally say this in real life, but what is the beef with these granny flats? I like saying it.
The beef really is coming from aldermen who represent mostly residential districts. The biggest, most vocal proponent has been Marty Quinn, 13th Ward, Southwest Side, around Midway Airport, the bungalow belt, right?
Yeah.
And basically, he is saying that this would give up control, aldermanic control, over adding density to his community and would hurt the character of his and other similar communities. That's gotten pushback from a lot of the people who say this is actually a way to add gentle density, maybe a unit here, unit there, but it wouldn't be this grand swell of units because there are a whole variety of factors into whether or not people can actually do these,
yeah,
right? You still have to... It'd be a considerable investment to build an ADU on your property.
And not everyone has the means to be able to do something like that. But Quinn brings up an interesting point there, Sarah, that the measure is going to weaken aldermanic prerogative. Do you think that aldermen will vote to give up power over what gets built in their wards? Is there a world where that happens?
In this case, I think they will. Because there's a lot of good evidence that these type of dwellings are beneficial. And like Quinn said, it's not like you can build 20 places on your lot. You're going to be able to build maybe one, right? And so it's not huge. And also, there is a severe housing crisis in Chicago. I mean, there's a lot of people who cannot find affordable places to live. And, if you can build this type of housing and offer it maybe a little more affordably, that would probably be a positive. And I think a lot of aldermen see that.
Yeah. So what's next then, Quinn? I know we wait till September, but could there be some more compromise before that?
There might be. Actually, right before this was, it was about to come up for a final vote in the city council before it was actually deferred by Alderman Quinn and another alderman. There was some jockeying to add even more guardrails, so-called, into this. One would have been to require homeowners in certain residential districts to seek an administrative adjustment to build an ADU, which is this very technical, wonky thing. It's not quite a zoning change, but you have to go to the city's zoning administrator. There would be a kind of public notice period. So that could be in the final legislation. We might see other stipulations added. Mm-hmm. I know that is a big priority for the backers, especially Mayor Johnson. He cited this in his Cut the Tape initiative, which aims to kind of streamline development and get rid of a lot of, you know, bureaucratic holdups that are, you know, slowing down the construction of all housing and affordable housing.
Yeah. The council confronted a few more development issues as well. Lots on the table on Wednesday. There was drama over a controversial project. This is on the western edge of Lincoln Park. Tell us more.
So we were talking about aldermanic prerogative, which is this long-held kind of unwritten practice that gives aldermen the final say over development in their ward. Well, this was a kind of test case here in Lincoln Park. Sterling Bay, you might be familiar with them. They are behind Lincoln Yards, which is now stalled and maybe dead outright. We'll see what happens in the next few months. But right across from where Lincoln Yards is across the river, this Marcy Street development, they've been trying to build two towers to build around 600 apartments in Lincoln Park for years now, and they actually got approved by the Chicago Plan Commission over a year ago. But it had been opposed by some neighborhood groups and the local alderman, Scott Wagasback, concerns over the height of the tower, about parking, about this affordability designation that gets kind of wonky. But basically, it got stalled because the alderman was not, you know, in support. And finally, they reached a compromise this week. They lowered the units by a little bit. They really reduced the parking, and they lowered the heights of some of the towers, and Wagasback dropped his opposition, and it finally passed council, paving the way for Sterling Bay to, you know, go get financing and break ground on this eventually.
How were Lincoln Park residents feeling about all of this?
They were really mixed. There were some vocal neighborhood groups who were concerned about bringing in, you know, the density that this project would have brought in. But then there were a lot of people who were saying, well, we really need more housing in Chicago in general. And in Lincoln Park, you know, this could bring in over 100 units earmarked as affordable, and in affluent Lincoln Park, that could be really helpful. So people were pretty split on it.
Yeah.
And I think they felt, you know, the alderman felt like they had finally gotten as good a deal as he was going to get for his community.
This street is so symbolic, too, actually, because it's right between where Sterling Bay has been trying to develop Lincoln Yards, which has been controversial for years, as Quinn notes. And there's massive development just east of this street, Marcy, there. You have tons. I mean, anyone who's been in there, it's a driver's nightmare. You know, it's a traffic nightmare. But there's this street, Marcy, right there that comes up to the river, and there's just nothing there. It's completely industrial. Mm-hmm. And Quinn brings up, I mean, you ask, and we're talking about affordable housing. I mean, it depends what neighborhood you are in, because there are many residents in many neighborhoods who do not want affordable housing, which is what we've seen.
Yeah.
And Wagasback is, I don't think he is one of those alders that doesn't want more affordable housing. But, you know, this is coming up. And also there was news this week about Sterling Bay with Lincoln Yards, that now there's a new plan for it, that it's going to be a park, Foundry
for
Park.
For the northern, well, it's going to be it's going to be scaled back residential in the northern section.
Yeah, which I think everybody's kind of eager to see something happen with that space, since we've been hearing about development happening on it for like almost a decade now, I feel like, and nothing's happened with it.
Certainly since I've been in town. That's, what, 5 years? The council also passed a measure, Carrie, this one allowing for more development around trains. What are the details?
Well, this was about limiting parking that developers are required. They're required to have like 50% parking for new development, and that, and this, they're decreasing that because the argument being, if you live in this transit dense area, which is a goal in a city, is that people should have better access to public transit. So, you know, somebody who testified, I wasn't at council, but Quinn was probably, you know, said she lives on Fullerton, and anyone who's seen Fullerton and Clark, you have access to several bus lines, you have access to the train. And she's saying, you know, the argument being, why do we need parking spots when you could add apartments there, you could add housing there? I mean, that's the theme here, right? More housing. We need it. So, and fewer parking spots if people, maybe it will encourage them to take the bus or the train instead.
So the council approved cutting some of these parking spaces?
Yeah, they did.
I was actually surprised it got a lot of support from all factions of council, because parking is, you know, people take their parking so seriously in Chicago.
Yeah.
But I think there is acknowledgement from all sides of the aisle that there needs to be a streamlining of this process to bring in more housing, especially if you live in a Lincoln Park or a Wicker Park where you can take multiple bus and train lines. You know, there are certain arguments to be made for less transit-served areas, but I think in these TOD, transit-oriented development areas, this is definitely a win for building more housing.
Yeah. Well, two Northwest Side Alders, they were successful in getting their wards out of an anti-gentrification zone, Quinn. What does that mean exactly? And tell us more about the ordinance itself.
Sure. So this ordinance actually went into effect only a couple months ago. And basically across the Northwest Side, where a lot of families, especially Latino families in Logan Square, Hermosa, you know, up in Belmont Cragen, they have been struggling with rising rents, rising housing costs, taxes, et cetera. And this is kind of aimed at trying to keep people there, right? And one of the biggest tenets is this first right of refusal clause. When your building owner goes to sell the building, he or she basically has to offer it to the tenants first to give them an opportunity to buy it. So that just went into effect. There haven't been that many examples. There have been some, but not that many of this happening so far. And there's kind of this whole process that tenants have to go through to create kind of an organization to possibly purchase the building. But two aldermen, Gilbert Villegas and Felix Cardona, their wards are only a small part of their wards are in this zone. But they've said they've heard complaints from neighbors and that this is kind of stymieing the free market and kind of causing housing delays for sales and possibly hurting people's long-term investments of their properties. So they opted to introduce this measure to opt their wards out of the zone, and mm-hmm. they were successful. They got some pushback from affordable housing advocates, but essentially
of course.
They exerted, I guess, the theme of the show today is aldermanic prerogative. They said, not in my ward, and they were successful in that.
One last bit of housing news, Sarah. We now have data about the number of unhoused people in Chicago.
Right, and it's both good and bad news. I mean, there's fewer unhoused people who are newcomers, which makes sense because a lot of the shelters have been, you know, cleared out. I think only 17% of the people in shelters are newcomers. But there is an increase, and in fact, it's at the highest level of unhoused people who are long-term residents of Chicago. Mm. And so, you know, we're talking about housing. I think that this is where you see the housing crunch, that like people who have lived here for a long time can't afford to stay in the neighborhoods that they've been in mm-hmm. for a long time. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for another place to stay.
Yeah, I think when I was looking closely at the numbers this morning, what was difficult for me to wrap my mind around were these two stats. It says, you know, Chicagoans living in city shelters or on city streets, that dropped 60% between January 2024 and January 2025. But in the same breath, it says, despite the decrease, more people were unhoused in Chicago in January 2025 than at any point since we began conducting this survey in 2005. What?
I mean, it speaks also, I think, to the massive change of housing stock in Chicago. So we talked about granny flats, and, you know, it's a funny term, but the term comes from the fact that, you know, multi-generations would live in two flats, three flats, four flats, including your granny.
Right.
But like in places like Villegas's ward, which I used to live in actually, and sort of has this, it's Ukrainian Village in Humboldt Park. You know, those two flats, three flats that go up for sale, I don't know who can afford those. They're massively expensive. It's not like, and I used to have lots of neighbors who would own their flats for decades,
yeah.
You know, and it stayed in the family. That's how you keep it. But people are buying them and turning them to single family homes. So you go from having four apartments that you can put, you know, I don't know, up to 15 people in, to one home that you can put four people in. You know, it's just this constant changing of the housing stock that affects it as well.
Believe it or not, we still have more city council news, Quinn. What happened to the alder's attempt to override the mayor's veto of that snap curfew?
It failed. So
okay.
that's
moving on.
Moving on.
No.
You know, Alderman Brian Hopkins, the Streeterville and Gold Coast alderman, had been trying to, create this curfew ordinance that would allow police to issue a youth curfew anytime, anywhere. Some called it the snap curfew because of a clause in the ordinance that would, you know, require police to only give 30 minutes notice that a curfew was going to be in effect.
Mm-hmm.
Hopkins did say that it would likely be hours of effect, but in the ordinance, it only stipulated 30 minutes. This became a really big news story this spring as the city, you know, tries to figure out how to combat these so-called teen trends, teen takeovers, some of which have become violent in Streeterville and honestly all over the city, but the ones downtown are the ones that seem to get the most attention.
Yeah.
It actually was passed by the city council last month, but Mayor Brandon Johnson issued a veto. It was the first veto, mayoral veto in 19 years since Richie Daley. And then Hopkins tried to overturn that veto, like you would see in Congress, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that failed. He needed 34 votes to make that happen, and he only ended up getting, I believe, 28. So the veto, the snap curfew ordinance failed, and now we'll see what happens next, if other measures will be introduced or if police, you know, put forward anything else. But right now there will be no amendment to the youth curfew.
Well, Mayor Johnson actually sat down with me yesterday when he joined us for our monthly Ask the Mayor sit down. Here's a little bit of what he had to say about this.
We prevent many of these things from happening, but it's going to really require a real holistic approach to ensure that teens have somewhere to go, and that if they are working outside the purview of the law, that we have to hold them accountable. And I'm committed to that. It's accountability as well as opportunity. And if we all put our arms together,
yeah,
where we can have a budget that invests in people, but also ensures that we're holding people accountable when they step out of bounds, I believe that's the pathway forward, and not, you know, 20th century mottos that have proven to be ineffective.
So as Quinn mentioned, Sarah, this is the first mayoral veto, 19 years. So Johnson comes out then as a winner here with this vote. But how do you think that this goes over with the city's voters?
Well, I know that young people were celebrating this. I saw it on Instagram and, you know, other places where you see
you were there doing research.
Right. I was there doing research. But I saw, like, you know, some of the youth groups that I follow or whatever you do on Instagram said that they, you know, this was a victory for them. So I think they're going to be happy because, you know, they just felt like this was very unfair to be able to say, okay, now everybody has to go home by 8 o'clock,
right,
so quickly.
With 30 minutes notice.
Right. But, you know, adults are, and I've definitely heard people talking about being very fearful of large groups of kids, you know, gathering together because of some of the instances that you know, that have happened. So I think that people want to have a sense of security and safety. And, you know, I guess this curfew might have given them that, this idea of the snap curfew. But in reality, you know, I was always sort of questioning how you would really enforce this,
right. Yeah.
You know? So
yeah.
I think that's another question, right? I mean, you know, it's just like, what do you just get on a loudspeaker and be like, go home or else get arrested? I mean, that seems a little bit.
And
how
getting
do you
people
choose
in
which
and,
gatherings
yeah,
to
right.
interrupt.
Getting people in and out of the loop on a, you know, in 30 minutes is a logistical nightmare. People have to work. We saw that in 2020 when Mayor Lori Lightfoot raised the bridges. People were like, I got to get home. I work, you know. And let's be very clear and blunt here. In a few weeks, we're going to have a lot of teenagers in the loop
mm-hmm.
for Lollapalooza, and they're going to be there late, and they're going to take over, and I don't think they're going to be kicked out, you know? So, I mean, there's a push and pull to
that. It did seem like this was going to be very selective.
Very much a racial component here.
Let's leave city council, because we had major news out of Chicago Public Schools this week, which included some layoffs. Sarah, what should we know?
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting because I don't want to just say, well, 1,500 layoffs are, you know, routine and that's fine. But in reality, every year there are a number of layoffs just because schools, and I don't know if people realize this, each school in Chicago, like, sort of operates as its own little fiefdom, right? And so if something changes on the school level, there's fewer students, maybe fewer students with particular needs, the ratios of adults that you need in the building changes. And so those people who are not needed anymore are then laid off. And so this happens every year. And a lot of those people are then rehired for other positions in the job. CPS always uses a figure 80% are rehired into other jobs. So that's what this round of layoffs it was last week. And usually this happens all the way in May, sometimes even earlier than that. But we're very delayed because we had this, you know, we had the CEO transition, and also the school district is facing a very big deficit. They're trying to figure out how to balance the budget going into next school year. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of moving parts. The key thing to know is that these were not to solve the budget crisis. So there's a $734 million deficit, but these layoffs do nothing really to help solve that budget
deficit.
So that
1,500 isn't quite 1,500, but you still have at least 20% of people who will not get rehired.
Right, right. So maybe there's a couple hundred fewer positions, but Chicago Public Schools says overall, they plan to spend about the same amount of money on schools using this formula. So
what's the takeaway? How grim is the budget situation?
Yeah, so it's pretty grim. So right now, they are trying to figure out how to find really about $580 million. And that they don't want to touch schools. They don't want to have fewer teachers in front of kids and fewer assistants and things like that. But there's very few options they have. I mean, most of their budget is salaries and personnel and teachers. Yeah. So it's not that many options. In terms of revenue, Chicago Public Schools is very limited as to how much revenue they can raise. They can't just go out for to raise their tax levy. They don't not have the power like some other school districts mm-hmm. do. So there's very limited options. They're probably going to look into some, refinancing or borrowing, which was a very bad word. Last year there's all this talk about loans.
Oh yeah.
So
it's led to a CEO that's now gone.
That's
so,
right. Yeah. That's right.
We don't want to go down that road.
But I think that they're going to have to go down that road because, well, what are you going to do if you don't want to lay people off and you don't have money? You got to find it somewhere.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, in just the last hour, folks, Senator Dick Durbin wrapped up a press conference. He was voicing his opposition to the rescission vote. We pulled him aside, as we should do, right? We wanted to get his thoughts on how the funding cuts will impact us here in Illinois. Let's listen.
It's a conscious decision by President Trump to change America in significant ways when it comes to our point of view. This week, it was public broadcasting, television and radio, and they were accused on the floor of the Senate of being politically biased. In the past, it has been corporations who the president believes do not share his philosophy when it comes to diversity. And secondly, universities from the highest level. And third, unfortunately, we've seen it with law firms. And
yeah, Senator was very firm and very obviously disappointed in that conversation I had with him, because this is a difficult time for public media. You all have worked in or currently work in public media, so I want to hear how you're processing the last 24 hours at least. Sarah?
The thing that really scares me is not really so much what's happening in Chicago, because very little of our personal budget comes from the federal government. I am really, really worried about the small town that has a public radio station who's might now go out of business. And there's been a lot of media attention to the fact that those signals are often bought up by very biased media. And, whether it's very conservative media, some of the religious right will buy them up. And, there's not newspapers in those towns mm-hmm. in a lot of cases. There's news deserts, and we are creating news deserts. And this is, it's a very, very bad and harmful sign for our democracy, and it's very, very troublesome.
Yeah, when the senator talked to me, he mentioned at least two stations in the state that are very, very much so are looking down the barrel of having to shut the doors.
Yeah, probably from in his area, from downstate, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peoria, WILL in Champaign. I mean, that's funded by U of I, but that's a University of Illinois, but that's another big question is, all of these WNIJ is in DeKalb, it's part of Northern Illinois. If the pressure is going to be put back on universities to put even more funding into these stations, well, they're losing funding as well. I mean, like you said, I worked here. We all worked here. Durbin believes he would always answer the phone to talk to WBEZ. He does believe in this, I think, very, very deeply. And like Sarah mentioned, it's like, the rural stations where that's your only option for news, for NPR, for, even if it's jazz, it's classical, whatever, those mm-hmm. are probably going to go away if they don't have this funding.
And I believe the greater PBS takes a greater share of the CPB budget as well, right?
Correct.
So I think the public television stations are going to, in some cases feel this even worse than some of the radio stations.
I asked the senator if he thought the state of Illinois could or would step in to help and fill some of that funding loss, specifically for the smaller stations that we've been talking about. Here's what he had to say.
Our governor, J.B. Pritzker, has his own economic challenges his own budget issues, and I'm certain he was not anticipating that he would have that responsibility. If he can find a way to step up and help, God bless him. I'll praise him all the way. But I think many of them, some of them may end up closing down shop.
You know, I mean, the issue is that there's so many pressures coming from the federal government. I mean, you know, even thinking about complaining about money not coming into WBEZ seems sort of small when there's like cuts to health care, cuts to so, I mean, Chicago Public Schools is facing, mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so many things going on that it's hard to even know where to put your attention,
your focus.
And it's really hard to imagine the state or city stepping in to provide any money for public broadcasting. I know the mayor, I believe yesterday on this program, was asked by a listener, can the city of Chicago do anything? Well, they're facing a $1.1 billion budget, which happens to be the same amount that they just cut from public broadcasting.
Right.
But you know, I don't see, besides like maybe a little bit here, a little bit there, I don't see this being anything but the federal issue.
I'm curious too, how much the state is spending. Like Sarah says, I mean, we talked about this, you know, CPS wants money. Mass Transit needs money. They're facing a fiscal cliff from Springfield, who's, you know, they don't go back until October. So, you know, I don't know where J.B. Pritzker's going to get this money except from himself. But, you know, I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, I'm curious too, because we have all these lawsuits against, like Kwame Raoul, our AG, is leading all these lawsuits against the Trump administration. I mean, Illinois is regularly joining those. I do wonder how much that's going to end up costing us. I don't know the answer to that. I feel like that's got to be another pressure, financial pressure.
Sarah, to her point, I mean, Raoul has joined dozens of states in suing the Trump administration. I mean, Kwame Raoul has been busy since January
with these lawsuits.
They've been one after the other. But what programs specifically are being targeted?
Well, I mean, one thing we mentioned was Head Start is it's not just Head Start. There's a whole list of programs, Head Start being one of them. Also, career and technical education programs, community mental health and healthcare programs. Mm-hmm. A lot of different programs are being, well, basically they were told that you can't allow people without legal status to access them. And so that's, I mean, that's a big one. And so there is a lawsuit on this. Also, the Trump administration just froze like $7 billion of money that was already allocated to school districts across the country. Now, in Illinois, that's about $200 million. Now, he froze it, and I guess he could, you know, as easily as that, just have a magic wand and unfreeze it. But Kwame Raoul joined a lawsuit saying unfreeze it. Pritzker has talked about we need to unfreeze that money. This is money that's being paid for. One of the big things is the after-school programs. And so a lot of school districts start up in just like 2 or 3 weeks. They do not know, are they going to provide these after-school programs?
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in limbo. And, you know, people don't really know. Do you go forward? Do you not go forward? What do you do?
Hmm. Medical students also here, Carrie, they could be impacted by the president's big, beautiful bill.
I'm not calling it that. I'll call it his mega bill, spending bill. Yeah, they're putting a cap on how much you can borrow. So, you know, most medical, I think private medical schools, like, it's up to $400,000, and it's capped now at, like, you can borrow $200,000. Another big component of this that's a little bit in between the lines, and people who work in nonprofits like public radio understand this, that there is a program that your student loans can be forgiven if you spend a decade working in nonprofits like public radio. Mm-hmm. And this is similar for doctors, physicians who work in underserved or rural communities where there is a desperate need. There's a physician shortage. I think they're like in the next decade, they think they're going to be fewer, like an 86,000 shortage of physicians. These doctors go to these areas specifically, I think, obviously to help that population, but they can also get this loan forgiveness, and that's going away. So if you have this, so many are facing burnout, let's not even go down the road of what this means for the people they serve who are on Medicaid, who are going to lose Medicaid and that healthcare and are going to drop out of the healthcare system. That doctors are like,
I can't do it.
Yeah.
Like, our med students are like, I can't afford it. I
this
can't
might
do it.
Impact their decision to become a doctor. Absolutely. Take this path.
Absolutely. If you can't afford it, what are you going to do? You know?
The presidential actions are also once again impacting LGBTQ plus youth, Carrie. What's happening now?
Where do we start? Okay, so the latest is that just this week, there's the 988 is the suicide hotline. This is a federal hotline, and that's not going away, to be clear. But in 2022, they started a program where they specifically had counselors when people call, text, chat, who are trained to work with LGBTQ youth mm-hmm. who have very high suicide rates compared to their peers. And this is run by like sub networks of, the Trevor Project is one of them, if you've heard of that. The feds are no longer going to fund that. Illinois, we should say, it's law in Illinois, is one of, I think, 11 or 12 states that it's written into law in Illinois that the 988 suicide line has to be funded.
Okay,
so that's not going to go away. And they also came out with a statement yesterday saying they are going to continue to provide that service to LGBTQ youth who call. They will have trained counselors on the other end. I reported this story this week, and I spoke to a counselor, a therapist, who said, this is just another reminder of these young people being told they are not wanted and they are not welcome. And many of them, she says, she has young clients who have been disowned by their families. And there was this community, this external community. And an important point is that some of these young people, she said, have never been in the closet. That was an era before some of these young people's time.
Right.
All these LGBTQ activists fought really hard so that you wouldn't have to be in the closet. Mm-hmm. So some of these young people she's talking to are like, I don't even know how to be in the closet and not tell people mm-hmm. what my sexuality
because
is.
Because at the same time, these youth are still encountering obstacles that we've talked about before on this program.
Of course.
With gender-affirming care at local hospitals.
Yeah. Rush was the latest to say they are no longer providing gender-affirming care. We should say they haven't done gender-affirming surgery, I think, since 2023. We saw this with Lurie Children's Hospital, which was very at the forefront of this care for years in providing this and sort of a place for these young people. They also, out of fear after Trump's executive orders of losing more funding that they rely on heavily, they said they would stop providing this care. So now Rush is the latest to say that they are.
Yeah, they're pausing hormonal care for patients, new patients under 18.
Which is a very small percentage, we should be clear. It's not that many. These are not thousands of patients that they're pausing this for.
Yeah. All right. So quarterly campaign finance reports were made public this week. What did they show, Carrie, in that race for, speaking of Senator Dick Durbin, his Senate seat?
I know. I was wondering if you asked him who he's endorsing for his seat. You had other stuff to talk about, huh? So this is something we've actually kind of known, in that Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy from DuPage up in northwest suburb Schaumburg is like way ahead of the pack on fundraising. He's a very powerful fundraiser. He was as he ran for the House as well. So he's pretty far ahead. And Robin Kelly, who is currently the congresswoman in the second district, Southside, comes up second. And then actually Juliana Stratton, lieutenant governor, and obviously Pritzker's pick, who has the support of the governor and mm-hmm. many high profile Democrats, is kind of coming behind. But let's be clear, it's early. You know, it is indeed early, so I don't think we can call the race. They still have a primary to do.
Yeah.
We're talking about the mayoral race. That's even farther away. That's 2027.
That's so true.
So he's ahead of the pack right now.
Tell us what disgraced former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. is up to now.
Well, I think he's a host on WVON right now, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right,
so he has been out of Congress since 2012. This was after he was busted for stealing maybe $750,000 in campaign funds. Mm-hmm. He and his former wife, who was an alderman. And he is exploring a bid to run back in his former seat. It would have been his former seat. It probably, because of gerrymandering, redistricting looks very different. But in the second district, because Congresswoman Robin Kelly
is choosing to run for Senate for Dick Durbin. Do we have all that? Do you want me? I feel like I need like a board, like, you know.
Yeah, no, he said in a statement, it is my intention to secure a place on the ballot by, you know, by circulating nominating petitions in that second district.
Yeah, so. And joining his brother Jonathan Jackson, who represents the first district right next to the second district.
And it's already
district.
A crowded race. I think there are already like five or six other candidates running. And, you know, there's the one to replace Jan Schakowsky on the north side and Evanston. There are like a dozen candidates already. So, you know, we're seeing there's this generational shift we're seeing happen everywhere, but certainly in the House of Representatives. And everyone who has been in local politics now wants their piece.
Yeah. Do you think the Jackson name still holds enough clout, Sarah, that, you know, with the South Side and suburban voters, that they'll forgive him?
Yeah.
I think so, too.
Yes, yeah. Like, I think
your dad is the Jesse Jackson.
Right, right. And, I mean, those are beloved sons of the South Side. They grew up there. I mean, people, I've seen them out, you know, just like out and about. And I was at a restaurant on the South Side, and every table wants to shake their hands and say hi. So I think that's going to hold.
I will say it's interesting, you know, Walter Burnett's son wants to take his position in the city council. So we're seeing this, these kind of family political dynasties, you know, try to, you know, continue to keep power. And so voters will have a chance to decide at the ballot box if that is working for their ward, for their district or not.
So one politician says they will not seek re-election. I'm talking about State Comptroller Susana Mendoza, who ran for mayor back in 2019. She's been critical of Brandon Johnson, as we know. Here's a little bit of what she had to say this week.
I think we need a mayor who really takes public safety seriously and education for our kids, right? Who actually wants our kids to be successful in school and doesn't just talk about it, but implements policies to do that.
Did she say what's next, Quinn, or are we still speculating she might have her eye on the mayor's office?
Oh, certainly. I mean, this is a big wink, wink, nudge, nudge, if you ask me. I mean, she is saying she's not going to run for re-election as comptroller. She has long wanted to be the mayor of Chicago. She ran in 2019, was not successful. You know, she was tied to Ed Burke in the media. I mean, she, you know, had a close relationship with him. So basically, I think she is now laying the groundwork to run for Chicago mayor. She's positioning herself as, you know, definitely a more conservative candidate than Brandon Johnson, tough on crime, kind of, you know, pro-police, all of that. Yeah. And so certainly she is going to, you know, certainly is strongly considering running for mayor if she has not already made a decision.
Before you react there, Carrie, I want to hear what Mayor Johnson had to say, because he didn't wait long to fire back.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I don't think much about her candidacy. In fact, she tried this already, and apparently Chicagoans did not think too much of her candidacy either.
Ouch.
Spicy.
I mean, is this good, you think, Carrie? Pushing back against potential rivals this early, as you brought up earlier?
I mean, yeah, he has to. What's he going to say when he's asked that? Which he, of course, should have been asked at the press conference about that. To Quinn's point, I think I suspect she's sort of going to fill the Paul Vallis role of, you know, law and order, and this is what's, you know. But, you know, we have to be careful there because, as, you know, we've seen, and I know the Trib editorial board is sick of the mayor talking about this, but, you know, crime violence is down in Chicago, and that is something, a feather in the cap for the current mayor. Yeah. So is it going to stay like that till 2027? I mean, I hope so, but that's certainly something that Susana Mendoza will go after.
Mm-hmm. All right, so there's an update from the River North restaurant where 18 people right before the 4th of July holiday weekend were tragically shot, 4 fatally. What are the owners of Artists saying?
They're saying that they're closing, basically, that they can't keep going. And, you know, that they were getting pressure from the alderman who was saying that they opened under false premises. I guess they originally said that they were going to be a place of, like, happy, I don't know, I can't remember the exact words, but, like, happiness and joy. And, you know, the party that they held was probably the idea of happy, and it was also supposed to be a place that for Black queer people. And, you know, now this horrible tragedy happened, and he's saying that it was under false premises. And one thing I didn't know until I read an article about it is that they didn't have a liquor license yet. They were, it was BYOB.
Really?
It takes a long time to get a liquor license.
Yeah, but I never really heard of a bar that doesn't have a liquor license yet opening up, but I don't know.
Yes, I mean, a lot of restaurants are BYOB. Right. Yeah, I think that also that Alderman Riley said the false pretenses was that maybe the owners handed over the keys for the night, so to speak. He alleges that to this, you know, this party where this
was an album release party.
Yeah, but it is unfortunate. I mean, honestly, that spot is a tough, nothing stays at that spot, but it is, to Sarah's point, it was a black queer owned spot in River North, which is not that common, you know? So, I mean, that's unfortunate that, you know, they had to, but it's more unfortunate, of course, that there was a mass shooting there, but you know, that they just couldn't make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was the second mass shooting, I guess. I guess there was one just a couple years before that.
For a previous restaurant. Yeah. I mean, I do think, like, even if the aldermen had let them reopen, how do you really come back from something like this as a business?
That's
huge. You know, like, I do hope that these business owners can, you know, rebrand and come up with a new concept somewhere else. But this, you just can't come back from 18 people getting shot outside your restaurant. No.
Now, this is a favorite part of summer for plenty of kids from the Chicago region. But starting on Monday, it's going to change. What am I talking about? I'm talking about Six Flags Great America in Gurnee, where kids under 15 will soon need a chaperone older than 21 after 5 p.m., oh, man.
Yeah, you know, this is a terrible thing. It's a really terrible thing.
I'm guessing you have fond memories
from
Great America.
I have very fond memories of going there.
And when you were 15, you didn't have to go with somebody who was 21.
I mean, we were like 9 and 10 getting like on your own? A parent or an aunt or uncle would drop us off. Yeah. And we'd go, and my brother was a bit older, and we'd just go running around like crazy people for the whole day. But, class trips go there, like eighth grade class trips. Mm-hmm. Will they be allowed? Camps go there. And it's really, really sad. And they're not saying why. And we don't know a specific, you know, I don't know. I'm sure there's been instances.
Yeah.
Because you get a bunch of kids, you know, there's always.
Yeah, mine still go there. I mean, just at the end of school, my junior went there with friends instead of going to school on the, you know, you ditch the last day.
Sure. Right, right.
Like, we're not going to learn anything anyway.
Right.
True.
True. Let them go to Six Flags and have some fun.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
All the grades are in. Who cares?
Right, right.
What do you think this says about evolving times, how times have changed, Carrie? Quinn?
Well, I mean, we've already talked about it. It's criminalizing youth, I think, is what is kind of a trend here. Mm-hmm. To Sarah's point, I remember going there, when we were young, and it's just one, a few, it's not easy to find, that's the other thing, adults work, right? So, like, they need places for their kids to be able to go in the summer when they're out of school, so that's going to make that a little more difficult. I'm not a big amusement park fan, so I'm not shedding too much of a tear on this one, but I also don't have teens at home.
I'm over roller coasters at this point.
Yeah.
Another favorite summer destination is for kids is Brookfield Zoo, and looking a little bit different, isn't it, Carrie?
Wow, yes. Well, again, I haven't been there in like 30 years, but before this, but I did go last week because...
what do you do, Carrie?
Yes.
What do I do?
Adult no zoo, stuff, no not go to zoo.
A lot of stuff. Anyway, but they have this new like $66 million gorilla habitat. And I have to say, this press conference I went to, everyone was there. Like all the like major Cook County and some state lawmakers, Chris Welch,
the
Don
who's
Harmon.
Who was the all who's there who. For the gorillas.
Yes. And, you know, they're pitching this, the big thing about this being the idea of the zoo being at the forefront of sustainability, and that is something that they're really going to focus on, is educating people that these animals are extinct and why, you know, this is why you should care about them. They have like a pack of, I think, six there. And then they're building like another African safari. But, you know, Brookfield Zoo is a huge, everybody went there when you were little, you know, I mean, and you take your little kids there. It's a huge zoo. It's a huge attraction. I mean, the number of like economic impact that they cited was very, very high. So, I mean, this is a very nice renovation.
Yeah. So for those out enjoying themselves this week, you may have noticed something in the air. There were air quality alerts in Illinois, as well as northwestern Indiana and Wisconsin due to Canadian wildfires. Another thing that you may have noticed is traffic on the Kennedy. Quinn, I'm looking at you for a real quick update, because it turns out neighborhoods that are near the Kennedy also noticed it.
There's always traffic on the Kennedy, yeah. And there always has been traffic, especially the past 3 years as they do this rebuild rehab project. But something that we reported on this week is the traffic that's being pushed out, not just onto major streets on the northwest side, but on residential streets, people who live on St. Louis, Keeler, these smaller streets that are supposed to be residential, quiet streets. They're seeing blocks-long backups of people either cutting around, trying to, you know, beat some highway traffic, or trying to get to a different exit or on-ramp. And this caused a huge quality of life problem. I talked to one guy in Avondale. He said this spring it was so bad he was trying to go to work and get out of his street parking spot that he had to get out of his car and stop traffic with his hands, get back in the car, and drive away.
Oh, my goodness.
The frustrating thing is there's no, you know, they're putting up no through traffic signs and working on some signal timing things. But it's kind of, as one guy told me, a grin and bear it situation.
Yeah.
Hopefully it gets better when they finish the
just
construction
gotta do it.
By Thanksgiving. But it has been truly miserable to drive anywhere from like Bucktown all the way to O'Hare. It's just been terrible.
Yeah, I did it on Monday and came to work on time.
I did it Wednesday.
Miraculously. Yes. Okay, before we go, we talked earlier, it's kind of coming back full circle. We talked earlier about Congress passing that rescission package that ended funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But we'd like to end the recap with some good news. You know, the funding news was better for a North Suburban news outlet, Carrie.
Oh, yeah.
The Record
that
North
is a
Shore.
Good news. Yeah, the Record North Shore. That's a nice story. That is, they got some money from the Google News Initiative, which is about, which is Google, you know, giving money to local news sources. They cover the North Shore, Highland Park, Glenview, I think over there, and they're adding Skokie to their.
Nice.
So they're hopefully going to hire another reporter and cover Skokie, which is a very interesting, diverse suburb. Great food.
Well, we are certainly cheering them on.
Yes.
I'll leave it there, folks. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Carrie Shepherd of Axios, WBEZ's Sarah Karp, and Quinn Myers of Block Club Chicago. And we cannot forget this fabulous studio audience here in our performance studio at WBEZ. Thank you for spending time with us. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Daniel Tucker, and mixed by Micah Yasin. The news cycle moves fast, so our weekly news recap gives us the opportunity to slow down. If you enjoy our recap as much as we do, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around the city. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.